The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Good morning, how are you?
Okay, Tov, Howard. Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Getting geared up again for the Rabin Memorial. 25 years have passed since late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. And I read an article in the paper that says it doesn't feel like it's so long. Let's think about it in these terms. There were 25 years between the War of Independence and the Yom Kippur War, which seemed to be kind of two different eras, two different planets almost in terms of the times in which they took place. And yet the Rabin assassination, the Hebrew date of which is actually tonight and tomorrow, is kind of something which still feels like it's part of our modern era, still part of what's going on. And we see still so much of the conflict today that was prevalent in those days and that boiled out, boiled over into that assassination. Traditionally, the day has been marked year after year by programs within the schools and the education system about democracy. What is democracy? How do we exercise our democratic right? How do we not exercise our democratic right? Which was obviously the case of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. But we have an interesting dilemma these days, which is the question as to whether our democracy is actually being denied us by the regime itself. And the question this year is whether it isn't more about educating those in power about how democracy should be played out, rather than by educating the general public as to how they should exercise their democracy. And, you know, that's my view at the moment, is that, you know, democracy comes from two angles. One is which the way in which the regime allows you, affords you the right to exercise your democracy through elections, through the general machinations of state, how the operations of the government are run, etc. And of course, the people themselves, how they exercise their democratic rights. The other little angle to the Rabin assassination is, of course, the focus that was placed upon the Orthodox community, the religious community, given that the assassin came from within the Orthodox community, and the question as to how they've educated their children and how they could have educated them in such a way to produce this individual who would have the audacity to go actually and assassinate a prime minister. And there was certainly a lot of close inspection of the religious community, and many of them felt that they were under the looking glass, under the magnifying glass, in terms of being inspected every year on this date, on this anniversary, to see how they're getting along and whether they might have changed the way in which they conduct their lives to prevent such an event from happening again, to prevent the possibility that such an individual could be produced from within their system. So tonight is the 25th anniversary of the memorial of Yitzhak Rabin. Of course, the Gregorian calendar has it on the 4th of November, and I'm not exactly sure when the state memorial will take place, whether it'll be tonight or more likely tomorrow. But certainly there will be some sort of an event that takes place, that will take place and that has taken place every year at the graveside of late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin.
I still find it so hard to actually believe and accept that this happened. And it's 25 years, and I still feel there's still an element of disbelief from me that this would ever have happened in Israel.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think it goes further than that, because people felt that after this tragic and most horrendous event took place 25 years ago, that Israel would somehow use the event to rally together, to create some sort of a sense of unity around this event, that this is abhorrent and we couldn't possibly tolerate or wish to see this happen again, and that we could all agree at least about that one thing. And ironically, that has never happened, even though I think everybody would agree that this kind of an event is completely unacceptable, and nobody would ever support such a thing happening. We nonetheless see those splits in society continuing even around this event. People looking at it from different angles, pointing fingers in different directions, holding different people responsible for different activities that transpired then and that have transpired since then. Certainly no lack, no sign of any unity around this event.
Absolutely, absolutely devastating still. All right, moving on to another conversation, and we reported it in the news that that people born in Jerusalem, according to the Americans, will now be able to list Israel on the American passport. This is a big event.
It is quite a big event because traditionally U.S. citizens, when they are issued their passports, have the right to have the city and country cited as their place of birth. In the case of Jerusalem, that's not the case. In other words, that's not allowed. And instead, up until now, the U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem have simply had Jerusalem stated as their place of birth without any reference to a country. And this is because of the fact that the U.S. has historically said that the issue of Jerusalem alongside Judea and Samaria and some other areas around here are subject to agreement between the parties as to in which country they actually fall. So the U.S. administration, formally where this is concerned, has said that it will not officially state for now that Jerusalem is unequivocally part of Israel. And in fact, this particular matter was taken to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2015 when the Zivotofsky family sued the State Department to allow Israel to be written on their son Menachem's passport after he was born in Jerusalem. And the family argued at that time that the Congress had passed this law in 1995, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and they felt that as such, it should be listed on U.S. passports if U.S. citizens are born there. The court, however, disagreed on that occasion, and Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote that the recognition is a matter on which the nation must speak with one voice. And that voice, the judge wrote, is the voice of the president. If the president decides that the U.S. will recognize Jerusalem as being part of Israel, then that voice will go across everything, and those citizens who are born in Jerusalem will be entitled to list Israel on their passport. It now seems that the president might have changed his point of view, not this particular president, but the presidential office, because it has been announced that U.S. President Donald Trump's administration does plan within the next few days, even possibly before the election, to change the policy. And once that judge wrote that the voice is the president's, once President Trump makes that point clear, then apparently all bets are off, and that those U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem will be in future entitled to list Israel on their passport. I'm not clear whether that applies to historical births. In other words, whether the Zivotofsky family can return and say, let's reissue this passport and let's put Israel on it. I suspect probably that they probably could. Apparently U.S. Ambassador David Friedman, U.S. Ambassador to Israel, has done a lot of work on this. He's been fighting the U.S. administration to change this policy. And it seems as if though his views will finally be taken into consideration, and that change will be made shortly.
Well, it does seem a little bit strange to have the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, but then still claim that Jerusalem is not part of Israel, or that it's still disputed. So it is an interesting.
There's no doubt that the actions of the Trump administration over the past few years have very strongly supported this move, and it seems a logical progression from what the Trump administration has been doing in terms of recognizing Jerusalem and moving the embassy and all that kind of stuff, sure.
A huge public battle has erupted over the Tel Aviv metro system, even before it's gone into service. Gosh, there's a shock. What's the battle about?
Obviously, the city of Tel Aviv is like one construction zone at the moment, as the building of this metro system, the build-out of this metro system continues. The first line is currently being built. Stations are being dug, tunnels are being dug, stations are being built. There's huge amounts of construction and massive disruption that's been going on for years already in the city of Tel Aviv as this metro system is built in. And it was actually the Minister of Transport, Miri Regev, who threw the cat amongst the pigeons earlier this week when she declared at a real estate conference that she actually opposes the project. And more than that, that she intends to allocate budgets that were intended for the metro to develop other transport projects that would connect the center of Israel to its outlying areas. So here's the Minister of Transport who's effectively responsible for this whole metro system being built out, not only the first line, which is currently being built, but there's a plan to build 5 or 6 or maybe even 7 different lines in different directions, all running under the underground, mostly underground, not all of it, but mostly underground, the city of Tel Aviv, and connecting satellite areas such as Rishon LeZion and Petah Tikva and Herzliya and other kind of satellite areas all into Tel Aviv and underground. And in fact, it's quite interesting because that metro system is being used for so many other things, such as the municipality of Tel Aviv has decided that people whose the new buildings that are being constructed within a certain proximity of a metro station that has yet to be going to service or yet to be constructed, but those new buildings will not be allocated parking bays at all. No parking is allowed and no parking bays will be allocated to residents who live there because it is believed that they should be catching the metro when they travel around, and they will not be allowed to effectively have cars or not be allocated space to park their cars. But Miri Regev, of course, is coming at this a little bit too late, and the Interior Minister, Ariel Dery, has come out really backing the Tel Aviv Metro, which I think is probably 20 years too late. Because the transport around the city of Tel Aviv is really, really rough. Most people are using scooters these days, bicycles, electric bicycles, to get around. But actually, the most interesting view on all of this has come from Shai Agassi, who people might remember as having been the founder of a company called Better Place, which produced electric batteries for cars, which ultimately was unsuccessful, and the company unfortunately had to stop its activities due to lack of funding and due to lack of progress. But he said something else. He said that he believes that within the next 5 years, people worldwide, and particularly in Israel, will travel in fleets of autonomous cars. So there will be these cars driving around like taxis almost, which will be driverless, and which you will be able to order from an app. You will be at home. You will not need a car, because when you need a car, you just go into your app and say, bring me a car. The car turns up outside your house. You jump in. It's driverless. It's safe. It's running according to algorithms and using sensors and great technology. Drops you off outside your door and then moves on to the next call for the next person who needs them. And so if that's the way that the future is moving, then we won't need to have private cars, because you won't need a car waiting outside for you. You just call the car, and within a few seconds, it'll arrive outside your door. And of course, then people will probably not use much less metros and other public transportation systems. So those are the views that are being expressed at the moment on the subject.
Interesting, but I guess now that they're way into this, I can't imagine that it's going to be pulled to look at something different. And then, of course, the other thing is that the number of people that a train, a metro carries is very different to individual type of cars and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how this evolves. Anthony Wright, this is Where We Love and Leave You. It is 8 o'clock. We'll catch you on Monday morning. I hope you have a fantastic weekend. A Shabbat Shalom. Stay safe and healthy, and we'll speak to you then.